Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. Could I do a quick check of the volume? I have a new system. Does this sound good? Am I too loud or too low?
Nope, sounds good.
Okay, super. Thank you all. I know I'm a minute or so early. Thank you all for your responses to the questions. It's been helpful to me to see what kind of questions, what kind of focus and objectives you have. Particularly for this seminar, I'm going to depart a bit from the outline that you have to talk about some things that I think will more and better incorporate some of the questions that you have and respond to your inquiries about doing a bit more on case studies. So my dilemma, as I mentioned, is always wanting to give you more material, and I realize it's like asking for a drink and turning on the fire hose, but in my defense, I saw over many years of therapy and analysis what I've eventually incorporated into my parenting philosophy, that it's easier to lop off a little bit of too much than to fill in not enough. So brace yourself for another seminar of probably way too much, because there's a whole lot that I want to convey and share with you. First, thank you also for managing the background noise. This is pretty amazing. Are there questions or comments that you have, any reflections on last seminar about anything that remains or any impact that you've had as you've reflected on it, anything at all from our discussion last time?
Hi, Dave. This is Shannon Kelly. I really liked the white paper that you sent out. Hi. I found that really just fascinating. So thank you for sending and sharing that.
The neural conditioning chart or which?
It was the attachments.
Oh, the attachment paper. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, super. Well, good. Yeah, that's some research, especially from developmental psychology and psychoanalysis, that has not been applied to date, except for that paper, to coaching. But I think it has a lot to do with coaching, and ultimately, we're going to talk about the things that are one of the thing, I believe, that's the hardest in coaching, especially to really appreciate, is what's recreated in the process of the coaching, because it's what happens while you're talking about other things. And things like attachment patterns, emotional patterns, cognitive aspects, those are all recreated while you're focusing on other things. The easy stuff is, yeah, I need to create a system and a structure, and I need to figure out what to do next and to have SMART goals. That's relatively easy. The process is where we really earn our money, as we began to talk a bit last time, because that's from that 90 to 95% of the operating system that's not especially conscious, but the algorithms are there. We just don't see them directly. We see it in terms of behavior and the processes that occur. So we're going to return to that, but I'm glad you found it useful, and I hope it will be in applications beyond this. So thanks.
Absolutely.
Any other comments or questions or thoughts?
Hi, David. Suni Vasquez here.
What
was really helpful to me was a simple concept that you share about the story and changing your story. To me, it really had me thinking pretty much all week. And I can, in the process, about thinking consciously about it, I can see that I have changed up some of the stories already. So thank you for sharing that.
Great. And remember that the concept of story is one that I use and that I believe we can use as coaches. I use it as the basis of the licensed specialty certification training for New Life Story Wellness Coaches, New Money Story Mentors. But the important thing to remember is story is our concept. It's our organizer, something we can use to catalyze the process of change and transformation for the client. The client does not experience it as a story. For the client, the client's not doing a story. It's just the way things are. It's reality. So remember that it's our metaphor, and if we want to share it, we'll have to bring the client along to look at it in that way. But it is a way to get more objective, to be self-reflective. And we're going to talk in this seminar about some very basics of regulating states of mind and managing emotions in order to develop that self-reflection. So good comment to lead into what we're about to say more about. So thanks. Other comments or questions or reflections? Well, if not, we'll move right into the material. And again, if you tuned in even a half minute after I began, some of the material based on responses to questions that I think have been excellent and that I appreciate will create a departure from your outline. So don't feel lost. Just hang with me, and we'll I think it will eventually make sense and be organizing for you. That's my hope, at least, but not always corresponding to the outline. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and I'll come back. I want to save a few minutes at the end for questions and comments and clarifications. Okay. We're talking about mastery of mind states and also about neural conditioning. You saw, I think, if you've looked at your email, that I sent an attachment of a single page for the neural conditioning chart. Now, even though it's in your outline, I want you to have that separate page that you could work with. I want to discuss in this session what I think is probably the single most important variable to determine success for everyone, the mastery of regulating states of mind. So let's first look at just simply understanding. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information as well as how we respond. So a state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. So a key element in mentor coaching is to help a client become aware of various states of mind and to be able to focus on which state works best for what purpose. So here's an illustration, kind of an extreme and goofy example, but it's an illustration of how states of mind are like different software packages. And we each have several different states of mind, like a whole consortium of software packages. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go over and over. Now, if before you teach the rat, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, create a simulation of an anxiety or stress state, you can still teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine in the rat you've taught in that altered state, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can't access in its brain the pathway to get to the cheese, and in that maze, it can literally die of starvation. Now, re-inject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-dependent learning and state-dependent memory. So this is an example of stress. Another couple of examples, like post-traumatic stress disorder, or an extreme example like multiple personality disorder, where different states exist without the seamless blending that we all have, without even being aware of it. It's as seamless as the baton passing of an elite relay team. And a very common example is when we try to remember someone's name. We can't. It's right there. It's on the tip of my tongue. You just can't do it. And you go on and do something else later in a more relaxed state. Boom. The name comes easily. It's simply in a different state. It's very adjacent, but it's different. So a state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information. Each of us has a range of states with some awareness of maybe what state works best for what endeavor, how we enter and exit different states. So it's really important to become aware of which state to enter for a particular task. For example, if you want to do a creative endeavor, like creative writing, you need to enter that state because that's very different than a state that uses a totally different part of the brain, like editing. Similar task, but different parts of the brain, different states. So what state works best for everything from alertness to business endeavors to relaxation for sleep? So look at that neural conditioning chart that I sent you. And I want to, I'll share with you the story of a client a number of years ago where I first developed and refined a bit, an early form of that chart. So basically the neural conditioning program is a performance microsystem for managing emotional triggers and rewiring planned ideal responses. The neural conditioning program addresses evidence-based sequences to generate an optimum response at a behavioral and a brain level. And this simple proven mastery tactic will help you effectively manage states of mind and strategically manage your performance. It's a systematic architecture of state of mind regulation, and when you do it enough, when you, instead of responding to an emotional trigger by changing your state, the second column, and move into the fourth column by way of getting regulated, when you do that enough, it rewires your brain. So let's look at that specifically, and I'll give you an example, and this is where I've changed it a bit because I heard that you wanted more of like case illustrations. A woman I'll call Elizabeth consulted me. Let me say that a different way. Elizabeth paused during one of our mentor coaching sessions to focus on her executive leadership, which is what we had been doing coaching about, just to mention, so almost parenthetically, that she would be distracted over the Thanksgiving holidays that were upcoming. This is a very seasonal seminar, by the way. And looked forward to getting back and resuming her new work project at her company. I really kind of heard her discomfort and asked about her anticipation of the holiday. She said that she's aware of a pattern. She goes home each year to her family for one major holiday, but she has the same problem, the same pattern. And she described it with reluctance and embarrassment. Remember, this is a very successful woman in so many different ways, even in current relationships. We have a big family gathering where my parents, brother and sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave, this time is going to be different, that I will not get into arguments or struggles with my parents and brother and sister. I focus immediately on being balanced and not resorting to the squabbles and the upset. I can usually last most of the first day, but then something happens and I just lose it. I get in a fight with one of my family and then escalates, and then I'm in a fight with all of them. We're in a standoff for the rest of the whole holiday. That doesn't happen except when I'm there with them. I can maintain my cool any other time, even with telephone visits with them. Then in person, I just lose it. Anything you can do to help me with this? Well, I first reflected on how frustrating this must be for her to want an enjoyable holiday with her family and how upsetting it was for her when this was not the case. Well, she heartily agreed. Remember when we touched on state always before strategy and story, and empathic resonance to let her know I get it, and if I didn't get it quite right, she'll correct me. So, I ask, at the time you're in the middle of that upset and are in arguments with them, what's the age of that conversation? She knew exactly what I was talking about. That needed no explanation. Early adolescence, I'm 13 or 14, instantly and totally at that time, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. Barbara wanted a close, meaningful relationship with her parents and siblings. She understandably wanted to share her personal and professional successes and experiences and hear the same from her siblings and her transitions that her parents had made. But in a state triggered by this emotion, she only wanted to be right, to be heard, to express the anger at not being understood. I asked her specifically what she was aware of that triggered her reactions. She described a particular look from her dad, maybe a word from her mother, a way that her brother would gesture that would instantly create the state change. She hadn't been aware of those specific triggers until I asked her and kept asking her for more specifics. For example, when Barbara saw her dad's eye roll, she was instantly transported to that time capsule of anger and resentment and feeling controlled and criticized by him, not good enough, expecting negative judgment. 13 all over again. I recommended that she schedule a time to do a brainstorming session with herself, at least 20 or 30 minutes, where there were no interruptions, no distractions, that she could reflect on a different plan. I suggested that she write a list of each of the emotional triggers that she was aware of with each member of the family. Column 1. I emphasized that she remain grounded and centered while she was doing this. In other words, to remain as an observer, to not re-enter the state of upset with each trigger, because that would be re-traumatizing. I suggested then for each emotional trigger in her column 1, I just asked her to draw 3 vertical lines on a page and label them roughly what you see on your page, and that she put beside it in column 2 her usual immediate response, the thoughts, feelings, and behavior. This column 2 of her usual response is an instantly altered state of mind that includes thoughts, feelings, behaviors, negative self-talk that were all an automatic reaction to her emotional trigger. This was her age 13 time capsule, and by definition, everything in a time capsule is preserved perfectly. It was all right there, recreated by her. I suggested that she then schedule another brainstorming session with herself on another day, at least one day in between, when she would think about 2 things. One is a mantra for getting centered and present for each emotional trigger, column 3. And I'm going to give you an example of a mantra in just a bit. But a mantra is 3 parts. A cue to initiate the process. Barbara used the cue of touching her ring, something that was immediate. She could do below the dinner table or while she was sitting. Nobody needed to be aware of it. A focus phrase to align the energy field of her brain, and a physiology, such as a deep breath for relaxation. Each emotional trigger deserves its own pairing with the mantra, an ideal response. The mantra may be the same for all of these, because what you'll find when you do the mantra again and again is that ultimately the cue will induce that relaxed state so you don't even have to do the focus phrase and the deep breathing. Then, part of that same second setting, to write an ideal response, column 4, for each emotional trigger in column 1, to pre-plan an ideal behavior. This pre proactive planning instead of the usual reactive response where she got stuck in column two and remained in column two for the rest of the holiday, created a game plan for her personally challenging situation. She sent me her initial draft of the four columns. I emphasized at that point that the purpose of the first two columns was to cue her radar to recognize not only the triggers, column one, but also the resultant state change and content of the state, column two, as quickly as possible, and use the mantra to get grounded and centered, column three, in the present, then to engage in her ideal pre-planned response for each emotional trigger, column four, and to notice that everything about all four columns was her response. That's what she could determine. She couldn't determine the eye roll or the phrase or the triggers or the twerking by her brother or the snide remarks by her sister. In our first session after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was really eager to hear how it went. Remember, this was a time I hadn't done this neuroconditioning chart before. I knew that it could work in theory, and that if you go all the way across, once you do something enough times, it rewires the brain. It can even change an emotional trigger to be a cue for the ideal response. She immediately began the session saying it was the best holiday she'd ever had with her family. There were still times of challenge, but There were even times when she would excuse herself to use the privacy of a walk or just going to the next room to get grounded and centered again in order to engage the behavior that she really wanted. And I had mentioned that to her. I said, this is not the NBA. You don't have a limit of five timeouts. If you feel yourself getting triggered or getting upset, call a timeout. Leave the table. Go to the bathroom. Splash some water on your face. Take a walk in nature. You have an unlimited number of timeouts to get grounded, centered, regulated, not to get into or get very far into that altered state. And she was immensely pleased with her work, as I was for her. So Elizabeth came to realize that previous emotional triggers, such as the phrase, "Really now," from her mother, as well as the particular eye roll from her dad, could be reframed as the recognition of their humanness, of her adulthood, and the new attachment pattern of resilience that she now has for relating to them in an adult way. Remember, we talked last time how you frame something determines how you are going to respond to it. After significant repetition, she rewired her brain to create a different response to each cue rather than having each result in a state change. As she noted about her Thanksgiving experience, that was incredible, but it was really hard work. And my response to her, you know, I get how hard the work was and how successfully you worked. The only thing harder, as you already know, is not doing it. So that's an illustration of how it came about, and I wanted to share with you and have a separate page for that with your material so you'd have a reference to it. So let's look then at access to mind states. The regulation of feelings and states of mind really involves an understanding and mastery of access to a particular state of mind, like being present, to determine what you do then. I want to give you some examples. Possibly more dramatically than anywhere else, the regulation of state of mind with artists and writers to enter a creative state is going to illustrate here. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to enter the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin, and one of my favorite nonfiction authors, Diane Ackerman, wrote on a pine plank while soaking in a bathtub to free thought processes. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm so he could come back and recreate his experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house an evolving story. So the key here is the corresponding state of mind of the reader then matches with the author, because the author guides the reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of the imagery, the rhythm of feelings. And the most natural way of instantly regulating a state change is by focus. Think about, in a natural way, somebody's well into their third paragraph, and suddenly you ask them a question. They stop and refocus on the question. Or a crying infant who's inconsolable with all kinds of possibilities and interventions, suddenly you jangle car keys and he's startled and looks at the, it's an instant state change. So we'll discuss more about how to do this with clients. So what we're talking about here is how to regulate states of mind. The most important thing we can do actually to achieve success is to regulate states of mind, because that means that we pair an optimum state of mind with the task at hand. In performance, it has to do with developing in deliberate practice a performance flow and entering that same performance flow state, that same practice flow state for performance. So you practice the way you play. This is what we can think about in terms of entering a state that's consistent with what you want to do, because that state of mind houses all of the developed skills, all of the ways of proceeding that we have become familiar with and practiced at. So think about it this way. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind using drugs, alcohol, or some other substance or process or person to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can be compromising. Your state of mind, the particular software program you choose, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. And this equation can be very useful. Belief drives behavior. Behavior drives performance. If a client is not performing as wanted, look at the antecedent, the behavior. If the behavior is not optimum, look at the antecedent, the belief that's driving that. Because our beliefs are often part of that 90 to 95% of the operating system that's unconscious. And a belief, like a fact, is an anatomical reality. You don't just suddenly present a better one and have it override what's there. But that's what we specialize in, is facilitating and being a catalyst for the process of change and ultimately transformation. Because when somebody incorporates that change into their identity, that's what makes it permanent. So this is something that we want to think about as we look at and frame what we do. Our brain allows us to focus, and we actively do that focus, whether it's positive or negative. And how we frame that determines how we're going to proceed. Remember last time we talked about if you experience a brain activation, which is the same for anxiety or excitement as anxiety, then you head one way because it makes sense to be protective and head for cover. If you frame it as excitement and what's the opportunity here, then you look for possibilities. This is exactly what we do in coaching, why we don't go back and examine and do postmortems on problems or look at new ways of looking at the problem, but look at the possibility, at the challenge, at looking at creating a system of what's next and what's after what's next. So, in a way, asking effective questions can determine a state of mind. It's the power of focus. And we have several minds, two brains, and one focus when we operate optimally. The best mentor coaches are the ones who ask the best questions. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David just asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people want to buy a cup of coffee or latte, but he asked, do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? And listen to how Steve Jobs at the time convinced former Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO at Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life or you want to change the world? So here's something that can actively create that focus. I've done this with a handful of clients. Write down three questions that put you in a peak state. Each morning, answer those three empowering questions and feel the answer. Because you're already asking questions when you wake up, before you're even aware of it. What's going to happen? What am I going to be able to do today? This is just making it conscious, focused, and systematic. You're asking three questions before your feet ever touch the floor that put you in an empowered state. That sets the tone. That establishes the mindset, at least for the beginning of the day, and changes the focus to consciously engineer those questions that empower you. So let's talk a little bit more about the mantra, because this is a way to simply and effectively get grounded and centered. And that's the third column in the neuroconditioning chart. But it's something that can be really useful in a number of different ways. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage. That was lowest in their division nationwide. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. He suggested they dribble the ball twice, which was a cue. And while they were doing that, to have a focus phrase that would fit exactly what they're doing, like relaxed and smooth, and at the same time take a deep breath in to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. So this all happened while they're dribbling twice. Notice how many players do this when you happen to look at basketball. Additionally, he understood about the output channel, about practicing like you play. During practice, he would suddenly blow the whistle, ask the player to go to the line and shoot a free throw. If they made it, they got a break. If they didn't, four laps for the entire team. Because during a real competition, you're always off center. You get fouled, so you have an emotional reaction. There's a crowd either cheering or booing for you, depending on away or home, at least pre-COVID, and you go to the foul line. So it's much more challenging. You don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws and count the best ones. In 2 years, his team was number one in their division nationwide. So what this did, a cue was two dribbles, or it can be a personal gesture like touching your ring, a phrase, relaxed and powerful. Be sure the phrase fits what you want to do, like before a keynote. My phrase would be relaxed and powerful at the same time I touch my index finger and thumb. A deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. Ultimately, the gesture can induce that entire state. And remember to keep the phrase consistent with what you want to do. You don't want to be powerful when you want to go to sleep. You want to relax to sleep. So it needs to fit. In sports, the people I work with as professional athletes, the phrase needs to fit exactly what they do. For example, a golfer will need different kinds of performance cues. For putting, it may be relaxed and smooth, but for a drive, it's more about power. For a mid-iron, it's more about accuracy. So the phrase needs to fit what they're doing. So mantras can calm as well as keep you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation. So what we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. So to change behavior, simply change a neural association. And as you know, thinking positively is not enough. You can think positively for a moment, but then you go back to what's already established in your brain and the neuronal networks and connection. It would be like trying to change software program by booting it up and talking positively to your computer. It can happen, but it needs to happen systematically. And that's why the neuroconditioning chart is a microsystem focusing just on emotional triggers. So basically, what you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. A neural conditioning gets linked or anchored by the coupling of strong emotion to whatever's happening around you at the time. Now, there are two forces behind all behavior. The desire to gain pleasure, to move towards something, to do something, to achieve pleasure. And that's basically why we decide to do what we do, because we, how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. And the need to avoid pain, to move away, to protect. It's biologic. Both of these are biologically wired. So to understand the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological, just like pleasure. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis, trying to create success by creating more pain usually doesn't work nearly as well. It's like playing not to lose rather than playing to win. Playing to win works way better. To gain or prevent pain moves us in every personal and business decision. Examples of gain: promotion, make more money, improve our lives, get what we desire, have a better connection. Examples of prevent pain, which is also there as a motivation and needs to be understood, to avoid change. Hear that, because every client you have, are, and will work with will have this reaction with every step of change. There's a natural inclination to not want to do it because it's painful. Because you don't know the outcome. You can't predict it yet. So to prevent pain, to avoid change, to buy insurance, to save money, to stay away from something we're afraid of, and I want to add to wear a mask. To change your behavior, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. The need to avoid pain is usually greater than the need for pleasure. This drives a lot of human behavior. Neuroscientists have shown that an example here. And this can be measured in the brain with the pain pleasure and the pain center and the pleasure center. The nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, registers about half as much of a charge as the pain center when somebody loses 100. Let me say it a different way. To lose $100 is twice as painful as getting $100. It's about twice as painful to lose something as to get something. So it's a powerful motivation. So in a way, if you're not doing something you want or need to do, you may need to link more pain with doing it than not. Not a recommendation. If you don't have enough money or money that you want, somewhere in your unconscious mind, you link greater pain to having it. Now, this doesn't make sense, but this is an example of a surface story and a shadow story. The surface story is I want to generate more money and create wealth. And if you have a plan, that's always the first question as a coach when somebody says they're not doing it, they're procrastinating, they're putting it off, or they didn't follow through. Do you have a plan? And if you have a plan and know what the next step is, then you can look at this. What may be the pain you're associating with not proceeding? Well, I'm just a procrastinator. Well, you know, I'm sabotaging. Those are not causal explanations. A procrastinator simply means you've habituated stopping yourself. Sabotaging is not an explanation for stopping to avoid pain, because that's biological. There's some pain you're associating. Now, the pain may be the shadow story. It may be, well, it's not spiritual to have money, or I'd be all alone at the top, or I have to take too much time away from my family and what I love, or I think if I really tried hard and fell on my face, I'd be so embarrassed. There's some pain that's associated, even though it may not be conscious. There's some shadow story that's being lived out. So when you're listening to your client and something doesn't make sense, it's usually the bifurcation there between the surface story and the shadow story, that those two are going in opposite directions. When they go in equal opposite directions, somebody is stuck. And that's the manifest of the two stories going in opposite directions. Somebody is just stuck. So a usual focus is, what will be the pain if I do this at an unconscious level? Maybe. Maybe not so unconscious. But here's a coaching question that will apply both of these. What's the greater pain if you don't proceed? And what's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? And that just simply puts into a coaching context these two motivations. So, what's the biggest addiction we have? Think about this for a minute. What is the biggest addiction that we all have? Yes, you included. The thing almost impossible to give up or abstain from. The pattern sequence that gives us an effective focus and really allows us, in a way, to kind of justify or escape our fear. Our biggest addiction is our problems. We always want to return to our problems. Think about your clients. You ask them about possibility and boom, they're back looking at their problem. They've got that down. Every time, though, they re-enter a problem, even ostensibly, to resolve it, it etches it further in their brain. That's why some people get stuck in therapy. So for any situation, there are three components: state, story, and strategy. State management is the most important aspect, to choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome. Strategy is to move benefits and beliefs to actual behavior for successful performance. Most of the time in coaching, we start with strategy and go into the story, but it's important to start with state. State always comes first, because state is what determines what's focused on, and state boots up the mindset to process the entire remainder of the conversation. So if somebody begins a session by saying, well, you know, I'm just so upset that, you know, that this happened, and then the natural inclination is to begin with the this and to create some strategies. But the first thing is that, think about it, from that person's saying, they want to feel understood. They want you to join them in their experience to know that you get it. So it may be a simple resonance empathically with, you know, I hear how upsetting that is. Well, Yeah, let's talk about that. I want to explain more. That's what's most important. On a paper, a separate sheet of paper, because you may want to write some more stuff on this, a clean piece of paper, draw a circle. Now, inside that circle, draw a stick figure. That stick figure is your client. Now, outside the circle, that client is really not going to connect or listen to you fully. Your challenge is to get inside the circle, usually with a clear understanding and an empathic resonance, even if briefly. Doesn't mean you agree, doesn't mean you're consoling, commiserating, sympathizing. It just means you are reflecting on what you believe and hear and feel is the most salient aspect of what someone just said, and reflect it back so that you're together now in that circle and you can go someplace new. Some of you have heard this before. The best supervision I've ever had about this concept came many years ago from a psychoanalytic patient, a woman, an executive, very successful woman. I offered an interpretation that I thought was going to be really useful to her, but there was a pause. And she kind of looked back at me. I knew something. She said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." The most brilliant, succinct way of conceptualizing that I have still ever heard. We have to be with our client before they can go someplace new with us. Otherwise, it's just an amplified form of information. So, now, for future reference, that circle and that stick figure, that's your customer for any products, because you have to get inside the circle. You have to know the challenge. That's how a story begins. Remember we talked about the three components of the story: the challenge, the development, the resolution. The challenge means you join with the reader, the listener, the viewer. You join together. Then you can go someplace new and develop it together. That's what you do with every client. You join together, go someplace new, and then have a resolution. So how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? There are basically three key principles of neuroconditioning to create change and make it last. First, identify together, once you've established this alliance, this collaboration, which is the quintessential aspect of professional coaching, the collaborative framework. First, identify what to change. You have to get to the point where you feel you must change something. Change it now and that you can change it. Must, can, will change it. And to feel that not changing it, and this is more from the client standpoint, would be ultimately more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. But this is something you're going along with the client step by step, resonating with the client's experience so they are not alone in it. This is the collaboration. This is the joining with. This is the, you got to be with me, then we can go someplace new. Change can be linked with pleasure. So questions to ask for this step: if you don't change your pattern, what would be the consequences? This is if it's a bit challenging. What's the pain associated to a current choice that now may be adaptive? Because sometimes it's a good way to stop and go run in the park instead of continue with what you need to do. I said last time I met a challenge on my computer system and decided to walk away from it. And third, what will be the pleasure with changing? Two, interrupt the existing pattern. This is one of the most common things that we don't do. We just add something on to what's already there, like adding on a health club membership to all the other stuff, or adding on a day. You don't do anything by adding. You got to disrupt a pattern. Because remember, the pattern is an anatomical reality in your brain. Whatever behavior, whatever feeling, whatever attachment pattern, whatever habit which is just a series of repetitions of the same choice that gets repeated, gets wired. A pattern has to be interrupted to change neural conditioning and to create a different mindset. So two questions for this. What are the cues or triggers for that automatic pattern? And think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified it. This is also the neural conditioning chart. To recognize at a quiet time when you're just reflecting as an observer, what are the triggers? What are the habits that you have? What's the usual response? Part three, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have from the change. Create a new empowering association for the same cue. For example, if you're phobic about something, link feeling strong and powerful with that previous phobic stimulus. When you behave and feel differently, the problem dissolves by creating a new story. Jung said, some problems you can't solve, you just have to move beyond them. Now, again here, you have to have a system. You have to know what the next step is. Otherwise, it'll be too easy to say, well, you know. Some questions to ask for step three. What's the new association to the familiar cue or trigger? What is the specific change you want to bring about and the first step of that change? Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have with the change. So, and this is a story you know about, but sometimes it's helpful to review, in light of what we've just talked about, something familiar. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. I'm sure all of you are familiar with it. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp. Death was certain. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that about 1 out of 25 of his fellow prisoners somehow managed to survive. He set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. He found that it was what the survivors associated to that made the difference when they survived. 24 out of 25 focused on the death that was inevitable for them. But the people who survived developed a reason to survive, a purpose, a meaning for their suffering, rather than just succumbing to their fate, wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving that moved them beyond the immediate. They could tell their story to their children to make certain that kind of suffering would never happen again, for example. It changed the meaning of their suffering. It reframed their suffering to something that could make a difference. The frame determines meaning. It also determines focus. Here's an example. Don't think about an elephant. Dr. George Lakoff, the social psychologist, wrote a book called that, and he talks about how framing determines everything that happens, whether it's negative or positive. You think about an elephant. Negative or positive, the frame determines the focus and then the meaning. So these are things that I wanted to share with you and to think about as you look at different aspects of what you're doing. There's some additional things that we can talk about, but I want to pause here and go back to to open mic, if you'll manage the background, and see what your thoughts are, what your questions are at this point. And again, I can always go back to adding some more material, but I'd like to get your responses and input about what would be perhaps more helpful even than what I have in mind. Okay, we're in discussion mode now, so I'm interested in your thoughts and questions.
Hey, Dave, it's PJ.
Hey, PJ. How you doing, girl?
I'm doing great. I have a quick question. This is so fascinating. Could you just briefly again touch on how a belief is anatomical?
Well, because anything that we do and do repeatedly, our brain hardwires it, and it becomes automatic, and it's an evolutionary fact that it's helped our survival when it becomes, we do something like, for example, a very simple, much more mechanical idea. Whenever we drive a certain way to work every day, you've heard me say this before, whenever we do that enough, it becomes hardwired because the brain, when we repeat something, develops its own neuronal networks and pathways dedicated to that and incorporating the components of that, both the process and the content, so that doing that 30 or 40 trips in a row, we got that down. We don't have to think about it anymore. We can listen to a book. It's become hardwired. It's anatomical. And notice how when suddenly that's disrupted, there's construction, you have to snake your way through the neighborhood, you can't really focus on the book. It's work to do something different. So the brain naturally resists change. This is how our brain, as well as our mind, resists change, because we want to do what's already hardwired. It's easy. It saves energy. That's what the brain is for, to make this automatic. George Costanza put it most scientifically. He said, I like things you don't have to think about. So beliefs are part more of the content than the behavioral patterns, but once we have a belief, then that also is part of our hardwiring. Think about, PJ, think about white racial framing. Think about how that's hardwired, how it's mostly unconscious, how people act on it, how it determines thoughts, beliefs, patterns, and behaviors without people even being aware of it, without being aware of its connection to white privilege, to various ways of looking and feeling and thinking. That's a whole complex belief system that is hardwired. So that's how a belief is an anatomical reality, because it's in our brain and we operate on it without even consciously deciding or thinking, but it just suffuses into actions and determines what we do and say and feel and think. This is part of why, this is part of how we earn our money in coaching, because so many beliefs, biases, blind spots, attachment patterns, for example, are not in conscious aware. They're part of that 90 to 95% of our operating system that's not conscious. So this is where we have to develop an alliance with our client so that we can get away with saying what we need to say, because you can't in session one or two blow somebody out of the water as they would experience it by talking about this kind of stuff in the way I'm just talking to you. Because I know a couple of things about you. I know a couple of things about your academic and your, you know, professional. I mean, so I know the example to choose, and I know I can get away with saying it, and I know you're not going to refuse to talk to me after I say it. We have a kind of a working alliance, although not, you know, coach-client, but a collaborative work alliance, so that I can get away with. That's the kind of alliance we need with our clients, to be able to collaboratively engage whatever needs to be engaged and the client know absolutely, without question, that we are 100% dedicated to their success. And that's our agenda, unequivocally and totally. Is that a sensible example to you? Does that make sense?
I'm so glad it's recorded.
Okay. Oh, by the time you listen to it, I'll probably change my mind, but, you know. Yeah. Is there a follow-up question or thought about that, and does that make enough practical sense to be of help to you?
I'm clear. It was just like, wow, I never thought about a belief being anatomical. So I'm good, thanks.
A fact is anatomical. Also, I mean, that's why, you know, a teacher can't just present a new fact and expect it's going to overwrite what's already there in the student's mind. That's why teaching has to be an engagement. That's why mentor coaching has to be an engagement, because we can't just present something to a client and expect it's going to change them. You've heard me say before, if information were enough, we'd all be wealthy, we'd eat mostly vegetables, all of that. But information is not enough. If information were enough, we'd all be out of business. We'd all be, you know, second choice to Google. So it's this process that is where our work really has importance and impact that I think can be immensely beneficial with our clients. Other thoughts, comments, questions? Let me give you an example. If there's not an immediate question, I have no more time to do it. Let me, if you don't mind going over, if you give me a minute and a half, I think I can do this. This is an example of a process that I wanted to share with you at some point. This was from a retreat to train an organization to develop its own internal mentoring program. I did a demo mentor coaching with one of the mentors. This was a retreat in a resort area for a fairly well-known organization. And I had a volunteer, thankfully. And the group kind of knew each other. So I knew I could get away with this to do a demo coaching. Need a management of background noise. If you could mute, please, star six. I can go back on, let me do that since, I promise to keep this short. I'll just go back on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about it. Thanks. This was a retreat for an organization for an internal mentoring program. I did a demo mentor coaching. I asked her initially what she wanted to focus on in our session. We were sitting in two chairs at the very front of the room. And she's kind of vague. She spoke in generality, the worst fears that you could imagine in front of a group. She was speaking in generalities about mentoring sessions with one of her proteges with whom, and this is what this organization did, is mentoring with people. So we were doing what they were doing, and this was a demo of it, with one of her proteges with whom she had significant challenges. And she was unable to get, I was unable to get her to focus more specifically on an agenda. And then I finally said, what would you like to walk away with from this session? And she couldn't get beyond vague generality, so my worst fears compounded. So after these unsuccessful efforts, I paused and I asked her if I could share a hunch with her to see if it might be helpful for us to consider, because she was talking about and presenting a specific case. I wondered if she was experiencing the same reluctance as her client to open up and share a meaningful exchange, preferring instead to stay at a distance, even though feeling stuck. Well, she confirmed that this was exactly true, that was exactly what she experienced in every session with his client, and said how embarrassed and reluctant she felt to share any of her struggles in front of her peers. So it was compounded. She was recreating the process, and she was creating her own process of her own reluctance. She had never before participated in a demo coaching or had witnesses for a mentoring session even. I told her that I understood entirely that it wasn't easy to share intimate details about an experience in front of someone else, and especially in front of a bunch of peers. I suggested that she consider her experience as an exact read of her protege, that the reluctance that she was experiencing with me and showing me precisely replicated exactly what her protege was trying to tell her, though the process of the exchange was not conscious or with words. She really immediately understood what I said and recognized that was precisely what was happening. She then began to open herself to discuss aspects of the engagement that were challenging but were accessible to her, and collaborated with me on strategies and ways to address the issue as a process rather than as a content. Previously immersed in her own discomfort, she was unaware of the unfolding interactive attachment pattern and the parallel between herself and her protege, namely that her protege with her was showing her exactly what it was like to be him. And she, right before me, was showing me exactly what this whole process was like for her. So it was a parallel, which is almost always the case. We came to see that she felt confident about herself and as a mentor, and then she could totally be present with me as she moved into that confidence. She knew she could help her protege evolve his story and dare to risk some of his experiences with her then. Her parallel of both the process and the attachment pattern in the engagement with me allowed both of us to see how her protege was teaching her exactly what it was like to be him, and how she was then demonstrating in vivo what he needed so that I could show her by proxy and respond to her in that way. So that's an example of a parallel process. Our clients are always showing us exactly what it's like to be them. They may not have the words. It may not be in their conscious operating system, but it's always there. I hope this was helpful. I hope this made sense. This was way beyond 2 minutes. Thank you for tolerating that. I look forward to picking up right here next time. Thanks very, very much. I appreciate it. Take good care of yourselves. See you next week.